Don't tell me what I'm saying. You want to ask me what I'm saying? I'll tell you what I'm saying. Don't tell me what I'm saying, all right?
I swear, it never gets old sitting here browsing through YouTube, finding video clips of Vince McMahon freaking out during various media interviews. It's actually quite an entertaining way to spend a couple of minutes. This is episode 225 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com. It is the first day of July. That would, in fact, be Sunday, July 1st, 2012. I am the Solid Monster. Thank you, as always, for downloading or streaming the podcast from wherever you may be in the world. We have a lot of international listeners out there, so I want to make sure they feel included. First, for those who have asked, I have not yet had a chance to watch the Ring of Honor Best in the World I pay-per-view from last weekend at the Hammerstein Ballroom. I heard good things about the show, heard that it was good to very good, by no means the best ROHI pay-per-view that they have done, but I know Adam Cole had a breakout performance on this particular show. And actually, for those of you who don't know and may not want to know, you may want to skip ahead here, a little bit of an ROH TV spoiler, but I know that Adam Cole is in fact the new Ring of Honor TV champion. I believe he defeated Roderick Strong, the most recent TV. So good to see them capitalizing on whatever momentum he may have. They're trying to create some new stars. Looks like it may be working, at least with Adam Cole. The Kevin Steen, Davey Richards main event sounds like it was a hell of a fight, more than a wrestling match. A lot of plunder involved, a lot of weapons. I think Steve Corino was involved. He may have turned heel in that match. And Steen retains his title and goes on a rant on the fans in New York City, cutting a shoot promo, a work shoot promo of sorts on the New York City crowd, talking about how, you know, Davey Richards, when he was champion, there was no harder working champion, and the people turned on him, and they turned on everybody else who's ever been champion, and Nigel McGuinness and all of that, but they can't turn on me, because you see, Kevin Steen hates the fans. And he even said to the crowd, he said, "Fuck New York City and fuck ROH." And apparently that only got the crowd to cheer for him even louder, because Kevin Steen is one of these heels in the company who gets a lot of fan support. And Kevin Steen, it sounds like, did everything in his power to try to get the fans to boo him, and it doesn't sound like it worked. And I don't think it would work, quite frankly. I mean, with an ROH crowd, probably one of the, quote, smarter wrestling crowds that you could probably work in front of, I just get the sense that if they feel that you're trying to steer them in one direction, that they will probably go in the opposite direction just to go against the grain. Sounds like it was a hell of a promo that Steen cut. I'm hoping to at least see the main event in the next couple of days. I just have not had a chance to actually watch it yet, so I can't comment on whether or not it was actually a good match. I'm sure it was. But I was happy to hear that ROH had few, if any, problems with their iPay-per-view feed. They've had a couple of misfires over their last batch of iPay-per-views and apparently have driven some fans away. I even got some angry letters and emails after the last show where people couldn't log in, and they paid money, and they couldn't, you know, and I had issues as well trying to watch that show, and it was just infuriating. And it sounds like things pretty much went smoothly this time. You would hope it's the first positive sign going forward for future iPay-per-views. Maybe ROH can try to bring some of those people back, but you'll have people that had problems and have been chased away and who aren't going to come back, and that's not good for a company. You know, ROH has a lot of great talent. I don't get to see every show, but what I do see is actually really good stuff. And it just feels like, you know, they're a company right now that doesn't have a whole lot of buzz. TNA feels like a company that has a lot of buzz. Their ratings really haven't changed. But TNA, for whatever reason, it's, you know, primarily the booking. I speak for myself. I'm watching full episodes of Impact now and actually most of the time figuring that Impact is better than Raw. I can't remember the last time that's happened. So you look at a promotion like TNA that has some momentum right now. WWE, even at their worst, is still the number one company. You know, they're always going to be, you know, like it or not. With ROH, it feels like, you know, they have TV, they do these iPay-per-views, and I don't really hear a whole lot about ROH. And I'm not sure why that is, but unfortunately, that just seems to be the way it is. And for them to have those issues with their iPay-per-views at that time when they were starting, I think the iPay-per-views were starting to build a bigger audience, and I'm willing to bet, I don't know what the numbers were for the most recent one. I know that it was offered free to a lot of people who had issues the last time, so probably didn't make a whole lot of money on this one. But anyway, hopefully they can recoup some of those lost fans put out pay-per-views in the future without any problems, because I can speak from experience when I say that there is no more infuriating an experience than having to sit on your computer to watch some sort of streaming pay-per-view and have nothing but problems. So hopefully they worked out the kinks as far as that goes. The other thing I want to mention here at the top of the program is, for those of you who may have missed it, I did a special feature for SEScoops.com this past week. You can probably find a link on the right-hand side on the main page to an editorial, a top 10 feature, actually, chronicling the top 10 matches of John Cena's WWE career. John Cena celebrated his 10-year anniversary on television when he made his SmackDown debut. It was June 27th of 2002. And he came out on SmackDown and had a pretty damn good TV match with Kurt Angle. Kurt Angle helped make him look like $1 million in that match. And I actually list that match with Kurt Angle as number 10. I ranked the matches from I can't say worst to best, because they are the top 10 best John Cena matches, in my humble opinion. But the Angle match on SmackDown that John Cena had back in 02 is on the list, because it really was a star-making performance. Angle made him look, like I said, like $1 million. It wasn't some new guy coming in, getting squashed by the veteran, and Kurt Angle making him tap out in 5 minutes of the ankle lock. It was a back-and-forth competitive match that went a good 10, 11 minutes, and Angle won with like a roll-up type of maneuver. So hardly a convincing victory. He kind of beat Cena by the skin of his teeth, so that's on the list. And a couple of other matches that Cena has had that I think are among his best: the Last Man Standing match he had 1 year at the Rumble with Umaga, obviously the Money in the Bank match with CM Punk last year, which tops the list. So if you haven't seen it, check out the list. Leave your comments underneath the article or email me if you have any feedback. I hope to do more features like that in the future. But I figured, you know what, to celebrate the occasion, because there's always so many horrible things being said about John Cena, including on this show, by the way. And I'll have more to say on that later on, as far as Raw goes. But let's look at the positives. You know, it hasn't all been bad with John Cena. I know John Cena gets a lot of blame for the, you know, ushering in of the PG era, which would have happened even without him. But people like to blame him for that, and you know, the fact that he's not a very good wrestler and his promos are annoying, and that's all true. But when you really look back on John Cena's body of work and his 10 years in the company, it's not all bad. And you can argue, well, you know, his opponents helped carry him to a great match, but, you know, he was in the ring with guys like JBL, and all due respect to JBL, JBL was never looked at as being a great master technician in the ring or anything like that, but, you know, Cena has built up an impressive resume on the big stage when it comes to big pay-per-views and pay-per-view main events, particularly in matches that kind of cater to more of a brawling style. I think Cena is more adept to brawls and kind of no disqualification type matches than a straight wrestling match, but he's had great matches with CM Punk and with Shawn Michaels and Kurt Angle, but also guys like JBL and Umaga and Rob Van Dam, and I think I even remember him having a pretty good, it might have been a Last Man Standing match with the Great Khali on pay-per-view once, and that was not on the list, but he's had some pretty damn good matches, and it's almost shockingly impressive when you look back on some of the big matches that Cena has had that really do feel special. You know, that match in the Hammerstein Ballroom at One Night Stand with RVD, with the crowd they had that night and everything riding on that match, it felt like a big-time main event. The match with CM Punk last year felt like a WrestleMania main event on a B-show pay-per-view. And you can't just give all the credit to CM Punk for that. It was the fans, it was, you know, Punk's final night supposedly in the company, but John Cena is part of that equation as well. So I figured, let's look back on his 10 years in the company and, for a change, actually show him some love and show him some respect for some of the big matches that he has had. So if you haven't seen it, go back and check out the top 10 list. Let me know what you think. WWE Superstars came to Brooklyn this past week. You may have followed me on, if you follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster, I posted a whole bunch of photos. I was actually in Brooklyn at MCU Park, which is the home of the Brooklyn Cyclones minor league baseball team. I've actually been to some TNA shows there, and we'll be there later this month as well. And WWE brought its Be a Star anti-bullying rally to MCU Park in Brooklyn, and I was honored to be part of it in some small way, helping out with the event. Got to meet Mark Henry, Zack Ryder, Natalya, Lillian Garcia was there. She sang the national anthem, which, to be on the field during the national anthem when Lillian sang that was a great experience. She is very good at that, as I'm sure any wrestling fan who has seen her do the national anthem on pay-per-view. She did it this year at WrestleMania. She's great. She's got a great voice. So it was very nice to meet all of them. I got to talk to some of them, like, you know, Zach and people like that briefly, and some of the WWE folks, and they were great to work with. And listen, I've said my piece on the Be a Star stuff before and how, you know, given my thoughts on various aspects of that. But this event, for one event to be part of it, was pretty cool. They were all very cool to work with. They brought all the kids out on the field to do all, you know, the Be a Star shout and the fist pump and all that. And I posted a tweet about one awkward moment when Mark Henry was thumbing through an event program for the Cyclones and came across an advertisement for a TNA wrestling house show, which was one of the more intriguing, if not awkward, moments of the day, because TNA is in fact coming back for a live event in a couple of weeks, and I'm actually looking forward to that a lot because they recently announced that Sting would be appearing at the ballpark for the TNA house show. And Sting does not make very many house show appearances. He's, in fact, I think he's only making two. One is the day before at a different base brawl show, and then he'll be in Brooklyn the following night. I don't know that he'll be wrestling, but he's supposed to be making an appearance. And I trust that, unlike last year when Ric Flair showed up and didn't even come out in front of the crowd and then left, and pissed everybody off, and I ranted about that on the Sound Off, and what a load of shit that was. I trust that Sting will, in fact, be appearing in front of the fans. So I don't think that's something we're going to have to worry about this time. And hopefully I'll have a chance to meet the guy. I've never met Sting before. Going into the TNA Hall of Fame in October as part of Bound for Glory. And hopefully the masked attackers who viciously assaulted Sting a couple of weeks back on Impact. We haven't seen Sting since, which I had presumed that perhaps he was kidnapped, a la Samoa Joe back in the day. And hopefully the kidnappers are kind enough to let Sting, you know, to bring Sting to Brooklyn. It would be kind of funny if, let's say, you know, the kidnappers drove up in front of the ballpark in this big black van and didn't kind of threw the door open and just threw Sting out onto the sidewalk and said, you know, we'll be back in an hour to pick you up, and then drove off. Hopefully they're nice enough to let him appear. So anyway, the Be a Star rally was cool. Got to meet a whole bunch of people, and if you want to check out some of those photos, you can go on my Twitter page and check that out. So that was really cool stuff. Start off with Raw this past Monday night. Monday Night Raw, episode number 996, I believe. 996 or 997, I forgot. I think a 996. A couple of episodes away from the 1,000th show coming up on July 23rd. And that, of course, is going to be the night that I presume they announce the new permanent general manager of both Raw and SmackDown. At least that's what Vicky Guerrero was teasing on Raw this past Monday night. But Raw this week was in Fort Wayne, Indiana, even though I don't know that they mentioned the city of Fort Wayne even one time on the show. Nor did they mention Evansville on SmackDown on Friday night, which I actually did watch. So I thought that was kind of interesting. They did say they were in the state of Indiana, but they didn't say exactly where they were. First, let me get the negative stuff out of the way. This show had three matches where someone came out with their music playing to distract someone or just outright interfere for the finish. That sucks. John Cena did an annoying promo on this show. That sucked too. Aside from that, Chris Jericho returned from his suspension. Psycho Sid returned to Raw for the first time in 15 years. And we got to see AJ Lee's amazing ass. That was pretty much Raw in a nutshell right there. So let's just run through some of the key parts of the show. Daniel Bryan beat Kane and CM Punk to earn himself a WWE title match with Punk at the Money in the Bank pay-per-view. AJ came out to distract Kane, which allowed Punk to nail the GTS to get the pin. For the first elimination, it was an elimination match, by the way. And then Bryan kicked Punk in the head and won the match. And later in the week, it was announced that AJ will be the special referee for the Daniel Bryan CM Punk match at the pay-per-view, which has me worried that the fans will be focused solely on the entire match on her and not on the match itself. But hey, at least we're getting the rematch at all. I was pretty sure they had just moved on from these singles matches with Punk and Bryan, so I'm very happy that we're getting another one. And again, the last 2 years of Money in the Bank pay-per-views have been excellent. I mean, there's a pretty good chance I'll be ordering this pay-per-view just based on that track record alone. And Punk and Bryan, I'm sure, will have another great match. I don't know if it'll stand up to the match they had at Over the Limit back in May. And again, the fact that AJ is going to be the referee in this match tells me that it's, once again, it's going to be more about the storyline than anything else. And maybe, you know, she'll count somebody too fast, and then, you know, Punk will be like, what are you doing, and so on and so forth. And that kind of takes away from the match itself. But I'm not complaining. Punk versus Bryan is a pretty damn good match, and so that's good at least. Big Show handed Brodus Clay what I believe was his first loss since his return in WWE on this show. If it is, I don't think the announcers mentioned it once, even though they were talking about... Remember a couple of weeks back, they were talking about his 22 straight victories or whatever. That was the first time that Brodus stood up to the Big Show and was supposed to have a match with him, and Big Show beat him up before the match. And they were talking about it like he was on some sort of Goldberg streak, and I don't think they mentioned it once on this show. And Big Show worked over Brodus's bad leg, and Brodus had to be assisted from the ring by the referees during the commercial break. And when we came back from commercial, they showed this great replay of Big Show just coming out of nowhere and punching Brodus right in the face, just knocking him out. And I just love how a 7 foot, 400 pound man can just appear out of nowhere. He's like a much fatter version of David Copperfield. You know, he did the same thing in that backstage segment a couple of weeks back with R-Truth when he knocked Truth out. How does nobody see him coming? That's what I want to know. They had this backstage segment where a totally rational, normal-sounding Kane basically told AJ to stay away from him because even she is too crazy for him. This is coming from a guy who once took jumper cables to another man's testicles. John Cena had teased throughout the day on Monday on Twitter, where else, that he was going to make a historic announcement on this show. And that announcement turned out to be that he was entering himself into his very first Money in the Bank ladder match. So, yeah, that was quite the letdown. Chris Jericho made his return on this show in the same segment, in fact, and he also made fun of what a historic, quote-unquote, historic announcement that was. Jericho was actually quite great putting over the importance of the match and how he came up with the concept of the match back in 2005, which is true. It was an idea that he pitched to Vince McMahon and the creative team for the very first Money in the Bank ladder match, and they went with it. So he's talking about all that stuff. He's making fun of John Cena's god-awful Star Wars promo that was just so bad I'm not even going to talk about it here. Vicky came out, said that it had been 2 years since these two men had a match, and so, and I quote, for the first time ever, she was making Chris Jericho versus John Cena for the main event. I know that WWE gives us a lot of revisionist history, but even that was a bit much for them, I think. Having somebody announce that, you know, these two guys had a match 2 years ago, actually many matches they've had, and so for the first time ever, she's making a match between the two of them. I hope it was just Vicky fucking up her lines and not something that was scripted for her, but that just sounded completely ridiculous. You know, here's an interesting question I just was thinking about to ponder. We know that John Cena now will be in the Money in the Bank match at the pay-per-view. And my question is, will WWE headline the Money in the Bank pay-per-view with John Cena's match again? Or are they actually going to put the WWE Championship match with Punk, Bryan, and AJ on last? You know, Money in the Bank, the last 2 years, has been headlined by a WWE Championship singles match. 2 years ago, the first show, it was John Cena, of course, and Sheamus in a steel cage for the title. Last year was that epic main event with CM Punk and John Cena. They don't have anything on the card this year that packs a punch quite like that match. I'm sure Punk and Bryan as a match could be far better than any match that John Cena would ever have with CM Punk from a wrestling perspective, but they don't have anything on the card so far this year that could come close, I think, to topping the drama and the intrigue going into the Punk Cena match from last year. Because it wasn't just that they went out there and had a kick-ass 40-minute match. Nobody knew how great a match it would be, but going in, it was all about Punk finally getting his opportunity after not being pushed as a main eventer for so many months, and people knew, or they thought they knew, that his contract was legitimately coming to an end, that he might actually be leaving the company. Would they put the title on him? Would they not put the title on him? There was a lot of drama and intrigue that none of these matches have. I guess you can say, will AJ side with Punk or Bryan? But to me, that's just another wrestling storyline. And the match last year felt like so much more. So they've got some big shoes to live up to here, to fill. But, you know, again, the last 2 years, you've had singles title matches in the main event, which is how it should be. You had two Money in the Bank ladder matches on these shows, and none of them have ever actually headlined the pay-per-view. So, obviously, I think they should headline with Punk vs. Bryan, but I don't think they will. I think that they're going to keep the Cena streak alive. I think this would make six straight pay-per-views or something like that he would be in the main event slot if, in fact, they put him in there. And I guess a lot of it depends on who goes over in that match. I'm not convinced that John Cena wins the briefcase. I could see, for example, Chris Jericho winning the briefcase. I pray that Kane or Big Show don't win it. Kane actually did win the Money in the Bank, I think, 2 years ago, if I remember correctly. And then he cashed in that night. And Big Show doesn't have to win Money in the Bank. I would almost rather see Jericho win it, just because most people probably assume Cena is going to win. And if Jericho as a heel wins the Money in the Bank, I could see them not wanting to end the pay-per-view that way. So I almost hope that is the plan, so Punk and Bryan can go on last. But it's an interesting question. I don't know what they do in that situation. This week, Heath Slater got to job to the master and ruler of the world. Psycho Sid Vicious makes his first Raw appearance since June of 1997 on this show. And I actually had to go back and check that out because I have absolutely no recollection of Sid being on Raw after WrestleMania 13 when he lost the WWF title to The Undertaker. I just don't remember Sid really being part of any sort of feud or storyline, and I had to go back and check it out, and he was on at least one show, if not multiple ones. He came back, I think his first Raw appearance back since WrestleMania, he interrupted an Undertaker Paul Bearer promo, and he didn't really do much. He ended up getting fired. I forgot why, although with Sid, you know, he's always had issues with management, but 15 years it had been since Sid was on this show, and I think a lot of people really only remember Sid for, you know, the video of him breaking his leg in WCW, which is still probably the single sickest injury I personally have ever seen sustained in a wrestling ring on a pay-per-view. A lot of awful things have happened, don't get me wrong. People have broken their necks and been paralyzed. I mean, one man died in the ring, for Christ's sake, but as far as injuries during the course of a match on like a WWE or a WCW pay-per-view, it's still very tough for me personally to go back and watch that video of Sid snapping his leg. So I give the guy a lot of credit, a lot of respect. You know, a lot of people would not have been able to return from an injury like that. You know, you can recover and rehab and lead a normal life, but Sid has been wrestling on the independents now for many years. He still wrestles indies, and you know, here he is back on Raw doing his thing. And I love how everyone is talking about how much better Vader looked in his appearance, and how Vader looked the same, but Sid looks so old. You know, perhaps the fact that Vader wears a fucking mask might have something to do with that. Just maybe, you know, just a little bit. Although I will say, you know, Vader overall did look like he was in, I can't say better shape because Vader is so much fatter than Sid, but believe it or not, even with the big gut that he had, Vader supposedly has lost a lot of weight recently. He did look pretty good, but again, the mask thing has something to do with that. Sid facially looked very old. He did. He's in his 50s, you know. Some people can turn back the hands of time and look timeless, and Sid is not one of those people. Sid is a guy who looks his age now. And again, he's had his share of injuries and issues, and he's been through a lot. And I think all things considered, he looked good. I wouldn't say he looked great, but he looked good. And I was just amazed that Sid actually showed up for the show, given his track record of no-showing indie events. I mean, at one point, the New York State Athletic Commission actually considered banning Sid from being booked by wrestling promoters on events in the state because of his track record. His track record of no-showing events is so horrendous. You know, Matt Hardy's girlfriend, Rebby Sky, went apeshit on Sid on Twitter this week for that very reason. So, the best part of the whole thing was seeing Sid bust out the powerbomb on Slater to get the victory. I'm pretty sure I've spoken about my love of the powerbomb on this podcast before and how I think we need more powerbombs on TV. But really, though, it's only effective, I think, with a big guy pulling it off. If someone like Tyson Kidd, no offense to Tyson Kidd, who had a big week this week, we'll talk about SmackDown in a second, but if someone like Tyson Kidd is busting out powerbombs, I'm sorry, but it's just not the same. Although I will say that powerbomb that AJ Styles busted out on Kazarian a week ago on Impact, that was pretty brutal. But there's just something about seeing a 6'10" or 7-foot dude picking somebody up for a powerbomb, a release powerbomb, and just letting that guy fly. That is still pretty cool. So I liked it. It was nice nostalgia. It was nice to hear the Psycho Sid music. I wonder if they bring these guys back again for the Raw 1000th show. Wouldn't shock me if Vader and Sid were back on the show in a couple of weeks. I don't see WWE doing anything with Sid beyond that. I mean, just because what do you do with the guy? You know, he looks, for his age, he looks fine, but he didn't look that great. You know, he wasn't moving around that great. I love how Sid, when he gets beaten on, like when Heath Slater got a little bit of offense and got Sid down on his knees, you'll notice Sid just doesn't sell. He just kind of sits still while the guy pounds on him, and then he just gets back up and recovers. He's got a very odd way of selling in that he doesn't. So I don't know that they do anything with him beyond this, but it was good to see him for one night. The other thing about Heath Slater that I wonder if all this increased TV time that he's been getting, all these squash matches with the legends, is ultimately going to lead to Slater having that match with Flo Rida at SummerSlam that was teased a couple of months back. You know, they had this little internet storyline going with Flo Rida, who's a pretty big star, you know, as far as you know, musical artists go. Flo Rida's pretty big, and he performed, of course, for The Rock, his entrance at WrestleMania. And they had this storyline going after WrestleMania where, stemming from that backstage skit in Miami where Flo Rida kind of shoved Heath Slater into a wall, they had this internet storyline where Flo Rida was doing this training video showing himself in training, teasing that he was going to have a match with Heath Slater. They had another video where apparently Flo Rida was a guest at a WWE house show backstage and Heath Slater beat him up and left him laying. And then it just kind of went nowhere. I haven't really heard anything about it recently. The belief was perhaps they were setting up for a match in LA at SummerSlam, so I don't know if that's what this is leading to, or if this is just Heath Slater getting some TV time for a couple of weeks until Raw 1000, and then after that, we won't be seeing much of him on Raw anymore. I don't know, but I would think perhaps that match with Flo Rida is not necessarily a dead deal. They announced that Brock Lesnar would announce whether or not he will fight Triple H at SummerSlam next Monday on Raw. Pretty sure that Paul Heyman already said no, but my guess is that after Hunter nailed Heyman, they do that stipulation maybe where Triple H has to put control of the company on the line or something like that. By the way, I don't expect Brock to actually be live in the arena for this, so if you're going to Raw this Monday night, I don't know where Raw is, but if you're going to be there, don't expect Brock to actually be in the building. I guess anything's possible. Paul Heyman perhaps will be there. But Brock is very limited in the number of dates that he is doing, in that he just doesn't have a lot of dates that he's signed for. And WWE does not want to run the risk of using up all of his dates, and then they can't use him, or they have to pay him extra just to show up. I know Brock is going to be on at least one or two Raw shows coming up in the near future. I would suspect that this one on Monday, he'll be doing some sort of pre-tape thing via satellite. But he is supposed to be on the 1,000th Raw show. I still feel that he needs to just slaughter Shawn Michaels or just do something heinous to Triple H's best friend just to get some heat on this feud. Or maybe, you know, they could even save the HBK attack if they want to do one for the August 6th Raw. August 6th is, I believe, Raw's in San Antonio, and it's being billed as HBK Appreciation Night. Now, I don't know if that's local in the arena, if it'll be HBK Appreciation Night on television or not, but I believe Brock Lesnar is now booked for that show. And if that is the case, they could do this whole HBK Appreciation Night thing on TV and just kill him that night if they don't want to kill him on the 1,000th Raw. But I feel like he's got to do something. It just seems like a natural thing to me for Brock to take out Triple H's best friend. And Shawn Michaels does not have to be on television. He makes an appearance every now and then. So to me, there's no harm in killing him on TV if he's not going to be back on TV for a couple of months anyway. Just let Brock go out there and just annihilate him. Put him in his Kimura, break his arm, you know, hurt him so badly that Michaels is coughing up blood or something, anything like that, just to get some additional heat on this match, because, you know, they're banking on this Triple H Brock Lesnar match for SummerSlam. And it's going to be a very interesting sign to see how well or not this show does as far as the drawing power of Brock Lesnar and the way that they have booked him since Extreme Rules, which, you know, on the one hand, I guess they're kind of handcuffed in that they only have him for so many dates, but, you know, that's the deal they made. And they knew that going in. And this thing has lost a lot of steam in recent weeks, and they've got to do something to really help it pick up. And I'm not sure that having, you know, Lesnar, I mean, what's he going to do? He already broke Triple H's arm, and you don't really want the two of them to fight before their pay-per-view match. So Brock's got to do something else, and it just seems like that would make the most sense to me. Dolph Ziggler and Alberto Del Rio had a pole match on this show. A cold chill went up my spine when they announced this. I feared that for a moment that Vince had panicked and perhaps brought Vince Russo back to the company when I saw that pole. At least there wasn't a jar filled with Viagra pills attached to a pole. If you think I'm making a joke, I'm not, by the way. You can probably go on YouTube and Google, I think it was Shane Douglas and Billy Kidman in a Viagra on a pole match. One of the many wonderful ideas from the mind of Vince Russo in WCW. But in this case, it was a contract for the winner to meet Sheamus for the World Heavyweight Championship on SmackDown. They did this wacky deal where they were fighting for the contract on the top rope, and Dolph pulled it off, but he dropped it, and both men scrambled for possession of it like it was a football or something. And apparently you need to have control of the contract to actually win. So it's a good thing Tiki Barber never had a pole match in his football career. And anyway, this was kind of creative. I will give them credit. It was a different spin on these pole matches, but it was all for nothing. Sheamus simply walked out. Of course, he, as we saw two other times on this show, his music played. He walked out in the middle of the match. He told both guys not to worry. He would be giving both of them a title shot on SmackDown Friday night. And this did not appear to bother the world champion at all, even though it puts him at a severe disadvantage because he's going into a match with not one but two other men where he, in theory, could lose his title without being pinned. So I know that Sheamus says he likes to fight. That would be WWE's way of explaining it, but this still doesn't make any sense. And it was just such a goddamn stupid finish to a match. I mean, wins and losses really don't mean anything at all on this show. At least with the Bound for Glory series, you know, it does feel like matches mean something on Impact. I will give TNA the edge over WWE when it comes to that sort of thing. They're trying to make those matches feel important. But in this case, they just don't mean anything on this show. So, and my belief is that fans actually do want matches to mean something. Maybe I'm just old school in that thinking. I really do think that people want to believe that these matches mean something, but apparently they don't. AJ won a Divas Battle Royal. If you only watch one thing from this show, you should watch this. Not because the match was any good or anything, but you must see the shorts that AJ was wearing. I don't even know if you could really call them shorts. It was more like a scarf wrapped around her waist. Whatever it was fantastic. Just wow. Just watch this if you did not see it. John Cena beat Chris Jericho in the main event by DQ after what else? Big Show came out to interfere. He gave Cena a leg drop while he was trapped in the walls of Jericho. By the way, they announced that the Raw Money in the Bank match would only include four men this year. I'm pretty sure they said it would only be four. All of whom are former WWE champions. John Cena, Chris Jericho, The Big Show, and Kane. That is easily the worst Money in the Bank lineup ever assembled. And I'm not saying the match is going to suck. The match may turn out to be really, really good. I'm just saying that lineup does not inspire much confidence. Big Show put Cena in a colossal clutch, is what they're calling the move. The colossal clutch submission, which is basically just a camel clutch. And that was how the show went off the air. So that was Raw on Monday night, just a show. SmackDown this week, I actually did catch most of SmackDown, believe it or not. I caught it on MUN2, the Spanish language channel, last night, which oddly enough broadcasts the entire show in English, which I was very happy about, but you wouldn't expect that the Spanish language channel would be broadcasting SmackDown in English, but they do. And they had qualifying matches on SmackDown for the Money in the Bank ladder match. Again, there will be two on the pay-per-view. Apparently, the other one you don't have to qualify for, you just have to be a former champion. On SmackDown, they actually make you fight for it. They make you earn a spot in the Money in the Bank match, which I like. And they had these matches throughout the show, and on this show, we had Damian Sandow, Tyson Kidd, Christian, Santino, and Tensai, who all qualified for a spot in the Money in the Bank. This is a better lineup, at least, than the Raw match. The purpose of a Money in the Bank match should be to give younger guys or guys on the undercard a chance to win the world title, to get an opportunity to win the world championship when they would otherwise not be getting that opportunity, and not just fill the match up with former world champions. I mean, to me, what is the point of that? Does John Cena really need to be... I mean, let's look at this for a second. I just thought of this now. Why does John Cena have to be in a Money in the Bank ladder match? John Cena has been a world champion, a WWE champion, 10 times. He could get a title shot whenever he wants. I know on Raw he said, I haven't gotten a title shot in almost a year. Or rather, he said he hasn't been champion in almost a year, which is true. And I think that's fantastic. But let's be honest here. Does Cena really need a Money in the Bank briefcase to get a title shot? Well, why should he even be in that match? It's just a waste of a spot, in my opinion. And filling up a Money in the Bank match with only former world champions, yeah, it's something different, but I think it just defeats the whole purpose of having a Money in the Bank match in the first place. I'm not saying that former world champions should be barred from participating in the match. I just think having a Money in the Bank match with only four dudes, all of whom have to be former world champions, is kind of dumb. That's all I'm saying. I would rather see somebody like Tyson Kidd or Damian Sandow or even Christian, who has been a world heavyweight champion, but has been, you know, now he's the Intercontinental champion. I would rather see guys like that, who also would probably have a much better ladder match than somebody like frickin' Big Show, for crying out loud. They're doing a losing streak angle with Jack Swagger, which we already know. Just watch TV any given week and you can tell. But they're doing it at the same time that they're doing a similar angle with Cody Rhodes. And I'm not quite sure how something like that happens. If one hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing, it just seems overkill to essentially be doing the same angle with two guys on the same show. I just think that's stupid. By the way, even though Cody was in a Money in the Bank qualifier and lost, it was a tag team match and he was not pinned. So he has officially filed a protest, we were told, and will likely end up getting into the match anyway. If he gets in and Dolph Ziggler does not, my money would be on Cody to win Money in the Bank. If Ziggler does get in, I would go with Ziggler. He has now lost about 16 times to Sheamus, I think, over the last month. You would think that at some point it's going to pay off. I suppose they could just swerve everybody by having somebody like Tyson Kidd win, and then Tyson Kidd could be the first person to lose, because at some point somebody has to lose. I mean, so far, every Money in the Bank winner has successfully cashed in. And really, when you think about it, if I'm a WWE superstar, I would much rather qualify for Money in the Bank than be in the Royal Rumble. Not just because your odds are far better with fewer people, but the percentage of those who win Money in the Bank is far better than that of those who have won the Royal Rumble. So, anyway. Cody, my guess is he ends up getting in and probably wins the whole thing, but if Dolph Ziggler can get into that Money in the Bank match, I would go with Dolph. I trust in Dolph. I trust that at some point there's some payoff in his future for all these brogue kicks that he keeps eating from Sheamus. There's got to be some sort of payoff. WWE loves to beat people down and make them lose, and make them lose, and make them lose, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, boom! They win something big, or they win the world title or something. That's what happened with Daniel Bryan. Daniel Bryan, if I remember correctly, was losing like every single match he was in. And then out of nowhere, he won Money in the Bank, and they didn't really do anything with him for a couple months. And then he cashed in, and he became the world champion. And he's a much bigger star now than he was 1 year ago. So here's hoping that Dolph can have some of that same success. Speaking of Dolph, he got beaten yet again by Sheamus. It was Dolph Ziggler, Alberto Del Rio, and Sheamus in a triple threat match. This match was actually really good. I like this match a lot. Ziggler, as I mentioned, ate the brogue kick and got pinned by Sheamus now for, I believe this was the fifth. It could be the sixth. I think it was the fifth time in as many weeks. And, you know, again, if he's in Money in the Bank, he has to be winning. He just has to. Finally, I have to make a mention of this. Ryback squashed two more victims on SmackDown this week, which in and of itself is not news. But what is news is that one of them is a listener of the Sound Off. One of our listeners is an independent wrestler named Barry Wright, who, by the way, unlike Taylor Hendricks on Impact, Barry is an actual cancer survivor. And Barry played the role of Dan Barone on SmackDown this week before being killed by Ryback. So, congrats to Barry on his SmackDown TV debut. He was also forced to rap before the match, which hopefully he will never have to do again. But anyway, he got the call from WWE and was very excited, as you might imagine. He got to chat with William Regal before the show and get some advice from him backstage. So, sounds like just a really cool experience for someone who deserves it. So, here's hoping for big things for Barry in his future. NXT from Full Sail. I did catch episode 2 this week. Have some thoughts really quickly on that. 7 matches on this 1-hour show. That is way too many matches for such a short period of time. And as a result, we did not have that great, you know, 15-minute main event like we had last week between Tyson Kidd and Mike McGillicuddy. We did finally have the debut of Seth Rollins, the former Tyler Black from Ring of Honor, who defeated a Japanese wrestler named Jiro. And Jiro is, I looked this up because I had not heard of him before, and he is a student of the Kaientai Dojo in Japan. He's wrestled in promotions like NOAH and All Japan. And, you know, I'm watching this and I'm thinking to myself, I actually like having Japanese wrestlers in WWE. I know that more often than not, WWE will just stick them with some sort of stereotypical gimmick. You know, they'll throw the Japanese guy out there with some, you know, a bowl of rice and what do you call those things? I forgot the utensils that you use to eat the food. Chopsticks, there you go. My God. Chopsticks. They'll throw the Japanese guy out there with chopsticks and a bowl of rice and, you know, a cymbal for a theme song. Because that's what WWE does. According to WWE, all Japanese people have poor English, and they all look the same and act the same. And you know, Yoshitatsu, as talented as he is, you know, he's relegated to superstars every single week, which sucks because Yoshi is one of those guys who I think should be doing a lot more than he is right now. But I look at this guy Jiro on the show, and I'm like, you know what? I like this. I would like to see more Japanese talents on WWE television. And then I go and I read that on June 12th, so less than a month ago, WWE released him from his developmental contract. Well, so much for that. I forgot for a second that these TV shows at Full Sail University were taped many weeks ago, so it's kind of funny that they released the guy, and here he is on television. Well, in some markets, anyway, on television. But yet, Jiro is gone, and I don't know if they have any other Japanese guys down there. I guess not. But so much for that. So back to Rollins. He looked good for the 90 seconds that he actually wrestled. He looks like he's having an epileptic seizure during his entrance, though, so he may have to tone that down a bit. I guess he's got this headbanger, mosh pit type gimmick. I guess that's part of his character. So there you go. The Ascension, which based on posts to my Facebook page, is apparently everyone's favorite new tag team, at least until they actually make their TV debut, and then everybody gets bored and turns on them. The Ascension beat Jimmy and Jey Uso on this show. I like their act, The Ascension. I think they have potential, but of course, a lot of that will simply rest on how WWE books them. You can have all the potential in the world, but if WWE treats you like a joke, if they book you to lose every single match, you're not going to go anywhere. You're not going to get over. People are not going to care about you. So a lot of that is going to have to do with how they get booked when they get brought up to the main roster. So it's all well and good if they're doing well on this show, but really in the grand scheme of things, it don't mean shit until they get brought up to the main roster. But they beat the Usos here, so that's a good sign. Richie Steamboat beat Rick Victor in Steamboat's NXT debut. His father, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, was in the crowd cheering his son on, which looked a little odd. You know, Full Sail University is where they tape these shows, and it's like 400, 500, 600 college kids, basically, getting in for free. And there's Ricky Steamboat sitting amongst all these college kids cheering his son on, so that looked kind of weird. But Steamboat, lots of chops, lots of arm drags, just like his father. He wins with a move called the Sling Blade, is what he calls this move. I'm not exactly sure what it was even supposed to be, which is probably a good sign that he needs a new finisher. But he has some time to figure that out. A fine match for what it was. Good to see him finally on TV. Antonio Cesaro was also on the show. He beat somebody by the name of Dante Dash. They aired another video package for Bray Wyatt, who has become my second most anticipated developmental debut behind Dean Ambrose. You know, both of these men need to be on the main roster right away. As far as I'm concerned, they both have characters and gimmicks that really intrigue me and are different. Unfortunately for Bray Wyatt, who was headed to the main roster shortly, based on what I understand, and he may still be, but it appears he may have suffered a serious shoulder injury at an FCW show on Friday night. He was part of a triple threat main event and had to leave the match early. He was assisted from the ring. That is not a good sign. And hopefully it's nothing too serious. I have not gotten any sort of injury update on him. I have not read anything since Friday night. I suppose if he is hurt, they could still bring him up to TV. You know, they'd probably run some vignettes anyway for him for about 3 or 4 weeks, then bring him on. You know, have him make his debut. He doesn't even have to wrestle right away. I mean, look at Damian Sandow, you know, for the majority, I think, of those first few weeks when he was brought up to TV, he wasn't even wrestling. You know, he would refuse to wrestle his opponent and walk off, and I don't think he had any sort of injury. It was just part of the gimmick. So they could still potentially bring him up. If it's something that requires surgery, of course, that's a whole other issue, and it could not come at a worse time, and that just really sucks. So hopefully the injury is not serious. But I just don't have any update on that. So keep an eye out for any Bray Wyatt injury updates. That may have a lot to do with when we actually see him on TV. Derek Bateman beat Johnny Curtis in the main event. It was okay. Way too short to mean anything. Not as strong of a show, NXT, as last week's effort, but I still love seeing all the new faces developing. It's still a fun show to watch. And the announcers were a weird thing on this show because they kept changing. You know, Jim Ross was there throughout, but first it was him and Byron Saxton. Then they brought in William Regal and Chris Russo, who I believe is the play-by-play man for FCW. Then they brought Saxton back with JR. It was like musical chairs with the announcers, so I'm not sure if some of this stuff was taped out of order or what the deal was, but I didn't like it. Pick one announce team and stick with it, or switch off every other week or something. Just don't do that on the same show. Speaking of Bateman and Curtis, Maxine, who did a love triangle storyline with both men on previous seasons of NXT, and was actually last seen in the Divas Battle Royal on Raw this past Monday night, she quit the company this week. And the reports were that she was unhappy with how she was being used or not used in WWE. And I know she posted a whole bunch of stuff on Twitter kind of explaining things. I couldn't be bothered to go read the whole thing. But, yeah, Maxine is gone. She's not the first diva to quit. I mean, I think I even made a comment recently about that on the Sound Off. I was talking about Maryse and the Bellas, and I think there was somebody else as well who, of their own volition, decided they were gone. They were going to leave WWE. They were going to quit or leave when their contracts expired. Gail Kim is another example of that. She was clearly unhappy with how she was being booked and even did some things on television that, quite frankly, you could perceive as being unprofessional by, you know, eliminating herself from a Divas Battle Royal and walking off and stuff like that. But she was just fed up and ready to leave. And, of course, now she's the Knockouts champion in TNA and I'm sure very, you know, very happy in her role and being used a lot better than she was with WWE. And the Bellas, I think it just had more to do with the fact that they were on the road for so long and they just wanted to take a break. And Maryse, you know, all these women, and now you could add Maxine to the list, who are almost revolting against WWE. And I think a lot of it has to do, quite frankly, with their treatment of the Divas. I mean, everybody has their own reasons for why they would want to leave. And I'm sure the travel and all of that has a lot to do with it. Kelly is another one who apparently is all but gone from WWE and is booking her own things outside the company. You know, I mean, and she's a very young girl, so I could see where she's kind of reached a point where she's been with the company for a good 5-6 years, and maybe she's just tired and just wants to take a break and do something else, and, you know, maybe she'll be back. But all these women who are just, they're just tired. They're tired of the travel, or they're tired of being not booked or booked to be a joke. The Divas really don't get any sort of respect on television at all. They're not even doing anything with Karma. I'm almost thinking to myself, I wish WWE would just give her a release so she can go back to TNA. I'm sure there's probably still some hard feelings there, but and really, I don't even know that she would be welcome back there at all, because one of the reasons she was kicked out in the first place, if I remember correctly, was because she attacked Bubba the Love Sponge, who was one of Hulk Hogan's good friends, and Hogan, of course, is still running things there in TNA. But you know, you look at the way that the Knockouts are used as compared to the Divas, and Gail Kim, with her history with Awesome Kong, I almost wish that she would go back to TNA at this point. She's just sitting at home doing nothing because they don't know what to do with her. You know, they had an idea that they would bring her back to kind of kill the Bellas, which would have been perfect because the Bellas were on their way out anyway, and there was already a built-in storyline there with the Bellas and Karma. And they wanted to swerve everybody. That's when they brought back Layla. That was not the original plan. So WWE swerved themselves into a freaking hole here, and they don't know what to do with Karma, who I think is the one diva who you actually could make money with. You can make money with her, maybe move some ratings. She's an attraction. She looks different than any of the other divas on the roster. You could do something with her and Beth Phoenix, perhaps. But they don't know what to do. They just don't have any ideas for her, and all these other divas are unhappy, and a lot of them are leaving, and it's just a very interesting thing to see. Just very interesting. So that's the end of Maxine. Let's talk about Impact here. Impact Wrestling from this past Thursday night. Another good show. A better show than the previous week. Certainly a better ending. A better cliffhanger for sure. Even the people who maybe still didn't like that ending, you can't tell me that this was not a better ending than the garbage. They're the refuse that we got the previous week with that first Clara Lynch appearance. This was much better than the way that show went off the air the previous week. And they had a bunch of qualifying matches, I guess, for the X Division tournament. There's going to be a tournament at Destination X featuring 8 wrestlers who will battle in 4 singles matches in the opening round. And the 4 winners will advance to the championship match that evening. The X Division title will be literally hanging in the balance in an Ultimate X match. And so that's the way that they're going to work it. And on this particular show, we had a bunch of people qualify. Sanjay Dutt was back, making his first appearance on Impact in a long-ass time. I think he was doing the Ring Ka-King thing over in India for a while. He was on this show. He had a match with a man by the name of Rubix. And Rubix looked awfully familiar to me. And the reason Rubix looked awfully familiar is because it was Jigsaw. Jigsaw is, he has been with the CZW promotion. He had also done some Ring of Honor matches before. I remember watching Jigsaw live at some Ring of Honor shows. Very good performer. And so obviously, I guess they couldn't let him use his gimmick name, so they gave him a new one. And I think he had a really strong showing for himself. In fact, him and Sanjay Dutt both, they had a kick-ass match. Probably the best match on Impact this week. And all I know is that double foot stomp flip thing that Sanjay Dutt did off the top rope to win the match, you could pay me $1 million. I would not take that move. I mean, who in their right mind would take that? Obviously, Rubix took the move, and he survived. And I know Sanjay Dutt is a professional. He knows what he's doing in there, but I just feel like one wrong slip and you can kiss your liver and your intestines goodbye. That's just, I don't know why you would even attempt to do a move like that. It looks cool, but just some moves are not meant to be used. And I think that's one of them. But they had a great match. I like how they have Christy Hemme after the match going up to these X Division guys to interview them after their victory. They did the same thing with Rashad Cameron, another performer from CZW. He had a match with Mason Andrews on this show, and had a really good showing for himself. He's also a former CZW performer, and apparently, as was pointed out to me, and I did not realize this, he also was one of the 2 jobbers who was destroyed in a squash match by Ryback on SmackDown about a week or two ago. It's interesting how both companies chose to take advantage of this man's talents. He looked really good on this show. His post-match promo was pretty cool. He didn't seem nervous or anything like that. And I like the guy. And so, anyway, he qualified as well. I believe that some current X Division stars who are also entered into this tournament, I believe Zima Ion and Kid Cash are some names I saw floating around. So anyway, there's going to be a lot of X Division talent at the Destination X pay-per-view competing for the soon-to-be-vacant championship. Technically, Austin Aries is still the champion. He was with title on the show, and as he explained, he will continue to be the champion until July 8th, the date of the pay-per-view. But I just like the way, I said before, that with the Bound for Glory series, TNA is at least trying to make those matches feel special. Like, wins and losses really do mean something. They had a couple of more Bound for Glory series matches on the show this past Thursday night, one of which was Samoa Joe against Bully Ray. And Samoa Joe, amazingly enough, it feels like he hasn't won a match in ages, but yet Samoa Joe has 27 points or something like that. I think after his submission victory over Bully Ray, he had 17. He beat him with a choke. Now he's got 27 points, which, if it doesn't make him the leader now, he's certainly right up James Storm's barking up his tree there. So that's pretty cool to see them actually doing something with Samoa Joe. I believe Samoa Joe is actually going to be fighting Kurt Angle at the Destination X pay-per-view, which could be a show stealer all by itself. But they had Samoa Joe and Bully Ray on the show, and actually, they opened the show with Mr. Anderson losing to Rob Van Dam in a Bound for Glory series match. So I just like the fact that they're trying to make the matches mean something. And with the X Division stuff, little touches like interviewing them after the match, because a lot of people probably don't remember Sanjay Dutt. A lot of people have never seen this Rashad Cameron guy a day in their lives if they never saw a CZW show, or I think he might have been on those Urban Wrestling pay-per-views as well. What percentage of that audience do you really think has ever seen this guy in their lifetime? Probably very few. So it's a nice little thing. You know, you talk to them, you get them to tell you who they are or cut a promo. And like I said, his promo impressed me. He's a guy with charisma and personality, and if I were ordering Destination X, maybe he's a guy I would be rooting for in that X Division tournament. So I like the little things like that TNA does that more often than not WWE simply does not do. The other thing on this show, they had the gut check results. It was the judges' week to collaborate, make their decision on Taylor Hendricks, who was the female performer last week who had a match with Tara, and you know that whole video about her. And I love how on Impact this week they specifically refer to it as a cancer scare, a cancer misdiagnosis. Notice they didn't use that word at all on TV last week, and I think they got a lot of heat for it, and they realized that, you know what, we probably shouldn't have done that. That was kind of classless on our part. And this week they made it very clear. They didn't even... I thought maybe that if that was something Taylor Hendricks did on her own and not just the way that TNA edited the video, I thought maybe Taz or somebody this week in judging her might take her to task for that. It never came up. They never brought that up. They referred to it this week, unlike last week, as a misdiagnosis. But Taz and Al Snow and Bruce Prichard, they have their own thoughts that came out. Joey Ryan is back. It is part of an angle, obviously. He was at ringside. We hadn't seen him since he got rejected in the gut check challenge several weeks ago. And there was Joey Ryan at ringside causing a commotion. Taz went out of the ring, took his glasses off. You know Taz means business when he takes the shades off. Why Taz has to wear sunglasses indoors, I don't know. He looks blind. He looks like Stevie Wonder sitting there at the announce desk. But when he takes those shades off, shit's about to go down. And Taz gets up in Joey Ryan's face, and the security comes over and has to separate the two of them. So that was pretty cool. Nice little angle there. And they get back in the ring to compose themselves, because they were in the middle of letting Taylor Hendricks know whether or not she was going to get a contract or not when Joey Ryan kind of interfered. And so in the end, it was Taz saying yes, Al Snow saying no. It felt forced in that I predicted. I knew the minute that Taz said yes, I knew Al Snow was going to say no. Only because you eliminate all the drama. You know, if Al Snow says yes, then it doesn't even matter what Bruce Prichard says because she's going to get a contract. You know, you've already had two people say yes, so it's almost like Al Snow has to say no. And then it comes down to Bruce Prichard, who, of course, at first teases that she's not necessarily ready and this and that, but he likes her, and so he says yes, and she gets the contract. And I probably would have said no, but these guys obviously see something in her, and you know they're the ones booking the promotion, not me. So if they feel they can do something with her, that's great. I just think back to the first person who won the Gut Check Challenge, that Alex Silva guy who has been persona non grata since he won. Now, apparently there's some visa issues that have to be resolved, and that's why he hasn't been on television. But goddamn, I mean, if you're going to give this guy a contract and you put him on TV and everything, you got to have that shit worked out in advance. I mean, the guy won. It's like Big Andy. Big Andy won Tough Enough. And he was on Raw that one time, got stunnered by Steve Austin. Okay, so what a great way to get somebody over, by the way. You just announced he won this big competition. He gets laid out by Steve Austin, goes backstage, gets chewed out by John Laurinaitis because he didn't sell the stunner properly. So right out of the bat, right out of the gate, you know, Big Andy is in the doghouse. Welcome to WWE. He is never seen or heard from again on television aside from a few vignettes they ran for him. And that was it. You know, he failed the drug test. He got released. Great way to get somebody over. The Tough Enough thing is a great example of what was the point of even doing a season of Tough Enough if, again, the winner isn't even on television. The people who ended up getting signed to contracts were one or two of the divas one of whom was the first person cut from the show. Anybody who was anybody on that show with any real talent, at least from the male side, whether it was Big Andy, who I don't think should have won, I would have chosen Luke. Luke, I thought, had the most potential out of everybody on that show. They never brought him in to do anything with him. I thought for sure they would at least give him a look and bring him into developmental. Nope, they never did anything with Luke. What was his name? Matt. Was it Matt? Matt Cross got eliminated. He was the second person eliminated. But there was another person on the show. What was his first name? I forgot what his first name was. Martin Cassius, who I really didn't see anything in at first, and as the season progressed, he got better and better and better and was winning almost every competition. Then he suffered an ankle injury. But Martin looked like he had something. They haven't done shit with him. They haven't signed him or given him a second look either. So what was the point of Tough Enough? You know, Tough Enough, the way they handled that season, I loved watching Tough Enough. I thought it was great. I thought Steve Austin was great. But it's in the follow-up. And if you're not going to do anything with these guys, what is the fucking point of having a television show with guys that you're not even going to put over on your own product when the season is over? With Gut Check, I hope that they don't do the same thing, in that if you're going to give somebody a contract, like Taylor Hendricks, for example, in my opinion, she's not ready to be on TV. She doesn't look like a very polished performer. TNA has a working relationship with Ohio Valley Wrestling. She would seem like a prime candidate to send to OVW. But, again, you know, you put her on TV last week. You gave her this really heart-wrenching video about her career and the cancer scare and all that, and she had a match with Tara, which she lost, but she had a good accounting of herself. She's back on TV this week. People want to like her. People seem to like her. If she disappears from television, what good does it do? Now, you got to capitalize on this, kind of like what they're doing with Joey Ryan. You know, that's the way to go about doing it, although with Joey Ryan, he actually got a no vote. So I'm more concerned about the people they're voting yes to. What are you going to do with those people? Hopefully they don't fall into the same Tough Enough trap that Big Andy and all those people fell into. There was a show-long storyline on Impact on Thursday where Kazarian had enough of Christopher Daniels. He didn't want to tag with him anymore. He said that Daniels had ruined his life. He made him turn on his best friend, that being AJ Styles and all that. He didn't want to have anything to do with him. And this screamed Swerve to me right off the bat. But it wasn't until the actual main event. During the main event, it became painfully obvious where this was going, and they went there. It was a tag team championship rematch, Kurt Angle and AJ Styles, who had... This was their first tag team title defense since winning the belts at Slammiversary. And they defended the titles against the former champions, Daniels and Kazarian. Kazarian would not help his partner at all. When Daniels was getting beaten down, he almost encouraged it, so it looked like he had truly turned a new leaf. And, of course, as the match progressed and the match came to a frenzied finale, it was Kazarian who clobbered AJ Styles with a really bad chair shot, by the way, to the back and allowed Daniels to get the pin. And so we have new tag team champions, Kazarian and Daniels. Of course, they never did turn on one another. Kazarian is still in the fold. They are the new tag team champions. Claire Lynch was back on the show, by the way. Throughout the entire show, they cut to these pre-taped things backstage where she was being interviewed by with Dixie Carter at her side. And it was funny because Dixie sometimes would almost kind of butt in with an answer when it looked like Claire didn't know what the answer was or was stumbling over her words. It was like Dixie Carter was her lawyer or something. And plus, it looked like they were being interviewed under a bunch of bleachers. I don't know where the hell they were being interviewed, like in the basement or something. But they had these things throughout the show where they tried to fill in some holes of logic. So, for example, it was revealed on this show the whole phone call that Styles and Dixie Carter were caught on, where it sounded like, you know, they were having an affair and Styles was asking Dixie, you know, where is Serge? Is Serge home? And this and that. And Dixie revealed that they, in fact, were planning for a surprise birthday party for Serge and did not want him to know about it stuff like that. They tried. They tried to fill in some of these holes of logic, which is, respectable on their part to at least attempt to do that. So they were sitting at ringside where AJ and Claire at the end of the show. And so Styles loses. He gets pinned by Daniels. They win the tag team titles. Daniels gets on the microphone. And basically the big cliffhanger this week is his revelation that Claire Lynch is, in fact, pregnant, so she's not fat. She's pregnant. And the child that she is carrying belongs to AJ Styles. And she, Claire Lynch, is crying once again, which is not her strong suit, so I wish she wouldn't cry so much. She's crying at ringside. Dixie Carter is outraged. She's standing up. She's shouting. She can't believe what she just heard. And that's how they went off the air. So if you're not a fan of the storyline, this is probably all bullshit to you. You're not going to like it no matter what. I at least think that this was a much better ending than last week. And I said last week that I prayed, I hoped against hope that that was not the end of this storyline. If for no other reason, because what an awful way to end a storyline. What an awful payoff that would have been. And thankfully, they had more planned. Either that or they quickly got together and said, listen, that sucked. We got to come up with something new here. But I'd like to think that they had more planned, and it was just one really, 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 really bad twist in the storyline. So, you know, now she's pregnant, possibly with AJ's kid. It's all, you know, wrestling storyline bullshit, but much better than last week. Much better. And the wrestling on the show also was much better. The Rubik's match with, I believe it was Sanjay Dutt, the main event, all very good stuff. And again, in my opinion, Impact, once again, I don't know if this is 3 weeks now, three, 4 weeks in a row now, but in my humble opinion, Impact, a much better wrestling show than Raw. So hopefully they keep it up. So let's move on to the shout-outs here and some of your mailbag questions. You can email me all of those things to thesolomonster@gmail.com, thesolomonster@gmail.com. This first shout-out here comes from Jeremy Scheidel. He says, I've been listening to your show for the past couple of weeks, and I've been loving every minute of it. You've been making life a lot easier for my buddy and I by saying everything that we think about wrestling. Keep up the good work and keep fighting the good fight. Also, if it's not too much trouble, could you maybe give Uncle Q and Jeremy, myself, a shout-out on your next show? It would totally make our year. So thank you to Jeremy. And there's your shout-out. I wonder what the Q stands for in Uncle Q. Very mysterious. It's like Q from the James Bond series. I'm still not sure what that stands for. Happy birthday to Terry Field, whose birthday was yesterday. I actually got a lot of birthday shout-outs this week. In fact, got one here from Rogan Barrow. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. He's from Curacao, a tiny island in the Caribbean, and has been listening to The Sound Off since episode 183. It is his 19th birthday, and he would like a shout-out. So happy birthday to Rogan. And Donnie Page is also hoping for a birthday shout-out. He is celebrating one today, in fact, July 1st. So happy birthday to Donnie. Anthony from London, England, just asking for a shout-out as today, July 1st, is my 30th birthday, and just wanted to say well done on producing an interesting and entertaining podcast each week. Yours and Colt Boom Boom Cabanas are easily the best on the internet, both great in their own way. One little shout out of my own, saying hi to my beautiful girlfriend who has put up with my love of wrestling for 10 years this year. She even went to a Noah show in Tokyo with me. That's a hell of a girlfriend Anthony has right there. So happy birthday to Anthony, and thank you for the kind words. And finally, Ted Hallowell from Pennsylvania writes in. He says, listening to episode 224, I thought to myself, wow, I've been listening to this show for a long time. Later on that night, I looked through the files I had downloaded and all the back episodes on SEScoops.com and discovered that episode 224 excuse me, was my 100th episode of listening to you bicker about wrestling. I had seen your podcast on the website before, but had never listened to it. Then I saw episode 124, 900 Reasons to Hate Raw and Its Ridiculous Lies. That must have been the 900th episode of Raw. How about that? Now we're heading into episode 1000. So anyway, he saw that podcast on SE Scoops, and he said, I knew I had to listen to it. I was wondering if I could get a shout-out for episode 225, since it will be my 101st episode. I really enjoyed the last 100, so here's to 100 more. So thank you to Ted. I appreciate that. I can't tell you how many people have written into me saying that, you know, they saw the podcast on SE Scoops and they just thought it was bullshit, or, you know, they just thought, eh, whatever, it's just somebody talking about wrestling, and they never really gave it a shot. And then one day, they see an appealing subject line or headline for the podcast, and they download it and they listen to it for the first time, and they're hooked. I have a lot of people who actually write into me saying that, and then they go back and they listen to the back episodes, and pretty cool. I wish more people would keep an open mind, though, and you know, start listening to the show, because I'm willing to bet there's a lot of people who go to SE Scoops who probably just don't pay attention to any of the special features or the podcast or anything, and they probably would enjoy the hell out of it if they gave it a shot. So to all of you who have recommended the show to friends, word of mouth is the best way to get people to check it out. I really appreciate that. I want to remind everybody, by the way, I may as well mention it here and now since I forgot to mention it earlier. I've been on a bit of an Iron Man streak. I can't remember the last time I missed a weekend without a sound off. Even in Miami for WrestleMania, we did a live show from, although I think that was on Friday night, but nevertheless, it's been a while. I've been doing a lot of shows. I haven't really missed one in a while, but there will be no sound off next weekend. I will not be around. I am heading to Las Vegas for the very first time, Sin City, for a bachelor party. Pray for me. So I'll be in Vegas next weekend and will not be around to record a sound off. Now, I will have some downtime for the Independence Day holiday midweek. I can't say that I will be doing a show during the week this week. It's a possibility if I have time. But there will definitely not be a new sound off next weekend, and we will be back the following weekend with a new episode. So in the interim, I may put together a sound off vintage show up on YouTube. I know people have been asking me about episode 3. It would probably be that one, maybe 3 and 4. I haven't decided yet. So I'll try to do something for you guys before I leave to get something up, but there will be no new episode of the sound off. Sound off will return in 2 weeks on SEScoops.com, so just be aware of that. I will not be available. I apologize if this inconveniences anybody in their normal weekly routines. I know people listen to the show at work and stuff like that, but just bear with me here. One week won't kill you, so that's the deal there. Let's get into some mailbag questions here before we wrap this up. This first message here comes from James from Scotland. He's 25 years old. First started listening to the Sound Off around episode 180. He says, but I've listened to pretty much all of them on SEScoops.com since then, and I've recently found even more earlier episodes on TalkShoe. I've been a wrestling fan since the early 90s. Although around 06 and 07, I stopped watching through the loss of cable television. I started watching again last year around the time CM Punk cut his infamous promo. The Solid Monster, Sounds Off, and Daniel Bryan are the only wrestling-related things that interest me right now. If I could find a word to describe WWE, I think it would be appropriate to call the product total shit. Wow. Tell us how you really feel, James. He says, I keep saying to myself, it's going to get better. Raw is on at 2 a.m. in the UK, and I often stay up late to watch, even though I'm starting work at 9 a.m. the next day. That's dedication. Stupid dedication, but dedication nonetheless. I'm coming very close to giving up on it, if I'm being completely honest here. Maybe you can convince me to stick with it. Anyway, I wanted to ask, what is your opinion on the Macho Man vs. Ric Flair match from WrestleMania 8? It's one of my all-time favorite matches, and I can remember watching it when I was younger and being blown away. Well, Macho Man and Ric Flair is one of my favorite matches, too. I don't think it's a match that, for whatever reason, gets the kind of attention and the respect that it should. You know, every year, WrestleMania, they do those videos and they talk about all the great WrestleMania matches. They talk about the same ones. They talk about Bret Hart and Steve Austin, Bret Hart and Owen Hart, the first ladder match, Hogan-Andre, which, by the way, as a match was complete shit. As a spectacle, one of the best of all time, don't get me wrong. It gives you goosebumps. I can only imagine what it would have been like to be there live for that body slam. But as a match, it was total shit. But they talk about those matches in the first Iron Man match, Undertaker Shawn Michaels, which to me is probably the best WrestleMania match of all time. There's been a lot of great ones, but you don't really hear about Ric Flair and Randy Savage a lot. And then part of me wonders if it was the placement of the match on that show. Remember, it was a double main event that year. And Hulk Hogan doing his best John Cena impersonation back in the day, or maybe it's the other way around, Hogan was in the main event, even though it was not a championship match. Ric Flair was the WWF champion at the time. Hulk Hogan was supposed to be his opponent. And in fact, they did this press conference deal, this angle on television that did air, where Hogan was selected by President Jack Tunney as the number one contender. Hogan versus Flair was not some idea they had that they ditched. This was announced on television. And then they decided, for whatever reason, that they did not want to do Hogan versus Flair. I know a lot of the house show matches that they had did not do as well business-wise as they had thought. Perhaps they were worried about that. I don't know. But they changed their mind. And they did this angle on TV when Sid turned on Hogan, and Hogan decided, I want Sid. And they just kind of put Macho Man in there as the replacement contender for the title. That championship match was kind of the took place around the midway point of WrestleMania 8. Hogan versus Sid, which was not nearly as good of a match, although it had a lot of heat. You know, the fans were into Hogan, and people loved the Ultimate Warrior return after the match. But again, compared to the Savage Flair match, not a good match. And that was the match that headlined the show. So people look at Hulk Hogan and Sid Justice as the WrestleMania main event, and I think some people tend to forget about Savage and Flair. I love the whole storyline going into the match, where Flair was teasing that he had been with Elizabeth. You know, she was mine before she was yours. They had these doctored photographs that ran in the WWF magazine when the magazine meant something and they wanted to get people to buy the magazine. I still have the magazine here with the whole photo spread of Flair posing by poolside with Liz, and they're sitting in their living room watching something on television. They're by the pool table. They're feeding strawberries to each other. And it was great because at the time I figured to myself, you know, they revealed later on the photos were doctored. Then they ran a separate set of photos that showed it was actually Macho Man with Elizabeth, and Flair had, like, I would say that Flair photoshopped himself in there, but Photoshop wasn't really a term at the time. It's kind of funny, actually, to look back on those days. You can have a conversation here in 2012 with somebody and say, yeah, I Googled myself, and I found myself on Twitter, and I'm thinking about, you know, Facebook tagging her. And I mean, if you had that same conversation with somebody in 1992, they would look at you like you were a mental patient or something. It's just amazing how the world has changed from then to now, and photoshopping is another term like that. But call it whatever you want. I love that whole storyline, and the whole thing was that Flair and Mr. Perfect were going to reveal to the entire world a centerfold a centerfold photo of Elizabeth that, you know, they were teasing it like maybe she's naked. They didn't actually say that, but if they won their match, they were going to reveal the centerfold to the world. And Savage, who was already a pretty wound-up kind of guy, is just beside himself because these guys are talking about his wife, for crying out loud. And Savage was just a madman at the beginning of the match. It was a personal issue between the two of them. And the match itself was great. The story was, you know, Flair working over Savage's knee. The finish, it wasn't even, you know, your traditional elbow drop 1-2-3 finish. It was Savage was in a bad way. He was being worked on. His knee was in really bad shape. Elizabeth ran down to ringside in the middle of the match. So all these officials and a young Shane McMahon is out there trying to restrain her. And, you know, Flair is in complete control and goes to deliver a punch. Savage blocks the punch, hits Flair. Flair turns around, and Savage clearly cheated to win. I mean, he used the trunks to pin Ric Flair. Bobby Heenan is on commentary, the biggest Ric Flair supporter there is, going apeshit because Savage used the tights, and then he left. He's like, I got to go down to ringside, and I got to be with Ric Flair. And maybe the best part of this entire thing was after the match. When the match was over, Savage now is the new WWF champion. He is injured. He is in the corner. Elizabeth is with him. Flair is yelling at the referee about Savage hooking the trunks. And so Savage in the corner, with his back turned, doesn't see what's going on. Flair comes over, spins Elizabeth around, and starts yelling at Elizabeth. And he's saying, you know, what about me? What about me? And he plants a kiss. He forces himself on Elizabeth. It's a form of rape that he now has committed on this woman. And Elizabeth was never known for being somebody to, like, fight back or be physical or anything like that. She was always the sweet little innocent manager. And, you know, every now and then she would do something, you know, she would whack Sensational Sherry or something. But here is Elizabeth now after being kissed by Ric Flair, fighting back. She's slapping him. The fans are going crazy. All of a sudden, Savage sees what's going on. He jumps over Elizabeth, almost knocks her down, tackles Flair to the floor. It is complete pandemonium. I mean, complete chaos. And the people in the Hoosier Dome, 60,000 people going crazy. Savage, even though he won, looked like a loser at the end here because Perfect and Flair worked over his knee pretty good. They left. They left it perfectly for a rematch. And it was a rematch, unfortunately, that didn't even happen until September. So, talk about waiting too long to pull the trigger. I know back then they didn't have any, you know, they didn't have pay-per-views every month, but, you know, as big as the Warrior-Savage match at Wembley Stadium may have been, I think they should have gone with a Flair-Savage rematch personally, maybe even in a cage. You know, even though it was an outdoor show, back then they had people come to ringside and actually erect the steel cage, so you could just set the cage up with the provision that the cage is meant to keep out Mr. Perfect. That's what the whole point of a steel cage match even was back in the day. Was meant to keep people out. Now they just do cage matches. I don't even know why they bother doing cage matches. It's just for the sake of doing them, I guess. But anyway, that's maybe how I would have booked things. But everything about that Savage Flair match, virtually everything about it, was perfect. The post-match promos. You know, they went backstage, and Ric Flair, who was bloodied, and the story behind that, of course, is that Flair got in a lot of trouble backstage because back then blading was not allowed. And Bret Hart had bladed earlier in his match with Roddy Piper, but did so convincingly enough that he claimed it wasn't a blade job. He got busted open hard way, and Vince McMahon bought it, even though it was complete bullshit, and Bret admitted it later on. Well, Flair couldn't get away with that because Flair used to blade in every single match. So, of course, Flair bladed, and Vince McMahon chewed him out backstage when the match was over for it. But, they, you know, here's Flair standing there with blood all over his face and being interviewed by Sean Mooney, and Perfect is there, and Bobby Heenan is there. It just was just great stuff. And then they go to Mean Gene, who's with Macho Man and Elizabeth, and Macho Man is just, I mean, he's gone off the deep end. And everything about this was great. So what my thoughts on it are very simple. Great match, great angle, great post-match. I liked everything about this. I feel like they could have done so much more with these two guys, and they didn't. Of course, Flair and Savage went on to have some wars in WCW. But as far as the WWF stuff is concerned, they could have done so much more. And that maybe is the only real regret about any of this that I have. But it's a match that doesn't get the kind of love I think it deserves. It was a great match. And it was the only Ric Flair match had, the match Ric Flair had, I should say, at WrestleMania back in the day. Ric Flair wouldn't wrestle again at WrestleMania until WrestleMania 18, 10 years later. he had that match with The Undertaker. So for his one and only WrestleMania match back in the day, I'd say it's a pretty good one for Flair to look back on. Matt writes into the Sound Off. He has a question regarding Matt Morgan possibly joining WWE now that his TNA deal has expired. Is WWE actually interested, or is it just rumors? What are your own thoughts on Matt Morgan, and do you think he would be a boon for the company, and how would you book him? his interest level from WWE is legit. The only problem is, you know, TNA filed that lawsuit with WWE over the whole tampering issue, and the name Ric Flair came up, and Jerry McDevitt, the WWE attorney, made it very clear on record that they had no interest in signing Flair, which is bullshit. I don't buy that for a second. But he did say, and this is on the record, that WWE has no interest in any current TNA talents, which is a lie, and that they had no plans of signing any of them. So now they've kind of painted themselves in a corner here where even if they have an interest in some TNA guys, which I believe they do, they almost can't sign them right now because then it makes Jerry McDevitt look like a liar. And if anything, that could help TNA's case. Now, who knows how long this case may go on for? I mean, this case could go on for months, it can go on for a year, it could go on for more than a year. Does that mean that WWE does not bring Ric Flair in for another year or 2 years, maybe? Same for Matt Morgan, Alex Shelley, all these different people. You know, Alex Shelley is a different case because he allowed his contract to expire, and Matt Morgan is the same thing. Supposedly his contract expired. So you can argue that it wasn't that they were stealing talent from TNA. Their contracts expired and they decided to come over, but the way McDevitt phrased it, he said, we don't have any interest in TNA talent. So it really is potentially a shitty situation for Matt Morgan, because if he figured, okay, I don't want to be here, WWE wants me, I'm going to let my contract expire and go there, now this lawsuit comes up and Jerry McDevitt is on record as saying this, it looks really, really bad if they bring Matt Morgan over right now. So I believe there is interest there. I believe Matt Morgan at least thinks he's going to WWE and probably will end up there. I just don't know when that's actually going to be. But if tomorrow, let's say, he went over there, what role should he play? You know what? He's a big guy, and they like big guys. I could see him as somebody's bodyguard, maybe. Matt Morgan is not exactly the best wrestler in the world. I might consider bringing him in as somebody, as like a bodyguard type for somebody, maybe even like a Dolph Ziggler or Cody Rhodes or somebody young, a young, cocky, arrogant heel, perhaps, and try to get both of them over, although maybe that isn't the best idea in the world, just because I could easily see WWE trying to get Matt Morgan over in that role more than the guy he's managing, because he is so big and they love big guys. I could see Morgan feuding with John Cena when the stuff with Big Show is over. It would be a new opponent, at least, for John Cena. I don't know how good the matches would be. But he probably should be in a pretty prominent role. To bring somebody like Matt Morgan in and just kind of keep him low on the undercard really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I think he's got potential. But whether he's coming in now or not, my guess would be no, just because of the stuff going on with the lawsuit. And the same goes for Flair. Supposedly Ric Flair has a non-compete clause from that TNA deal that you know, he was fired from TNA, basically, and he has a non-compete. I'm not sure how long the non-compete is for. If it's 3 months, which is typically what it is on a WWE wrestler contract, I believe it's 90 days. It could be 6 months. It could be longer. I don't know. But it may all be a moot point, since Jerry McDevitt said they're not bringing Flair in. We're not interested in any TNA talents. We're not bringing any of their guys in. He's going to look like a real fool if they turn around, you know, in a month or in the next couple of weeks for the Raw 1000th episode and they bring in Ric Flair or they bring in Matt Morgan. So that lawsuit is a big, potentially a big problem, I think, for any TNA people hoping to go over to WWE in the near future. Luis from Illinois writes in, at this point, is legitimate proof that John Cena was cheating on his wife more of a threat to WWE than any potential major injury that he might suffer? Absolutely not. Suffering a serious injury would be about the absolute worst thing that could happen to both Cena and WWE. You know, I'm not sure how much any of that stuff would even sway the WWE fan base, especially if you are a fan of John Cena. It's like Bieber fans, you know, Justin Bieber fans, of which I was around them recently. For work, I was over at NBC Studios for a TV deal with a client recently, and I came out and I literally found myself surrounded by an army of little girls in pink Justin Bieber t-shirts that said girlfriend on them. And I seriously, I almost wet myself. I was so scared. This is one of the most frightening scenes I've ever been part of. And they swarmed me because I was wearing a suit, and I guess they thought that I might have been with his entourage. I didn't even know that Justin Bieber was in town, but apparently he was performing the next day on the Today Show. And for like 2 days in advance, these nut jobs, these crazy women, these crazy girls were lined up outside NBC Studios singing, you know, lyrics from his songs, and they saw me and they came over. I thought I was dead. I thought, that's it, I'm gone. And anyway, the whole point of this is these people are psychotic. And I think, for example, if Justin Bieber was found to be cheating on his girlfriend, I don't think that all of the Justin Bieber fanatics out there would really care. If anything, they would probably turn on Selena Gomez and be like, well, yeah, she deserved it. She wasn't good enough for him. And this is how they think. When you're an obsessed fan, that's kind of how you think. And I don't know that if evidence came out, there was video proof of John Cena smooching with, you know, Victoria 10 years ago. Not 10 years ago. Not that anybody would even care about that. But it may be something even more recent than that. Unless it was something really explicit and really X-rated, like a sex tape or something like that, God forbid. I don't know that it's going to really matter much to the WWE audience, and I'll do you one better. I think the male fans would actually warm up to John Cena because they're all a bunch of chauvinist pigs. We are. It's just the truth. If there was a video that came out of John Cena, you know, hanging out with some of the divas recently, you know, two or three different women or whatever, I think John Cena would get more cheers than boos at the live events. I don't think it would really have too much of an impact. Now, I could see where, you know, the Make-A-Wish folks might look, you know, not so kindly on that, and I don't know if he has any endorsement deals or anything like that. I'm not saying it wouldn't be a black mark on him and the company, but you compare that to, God forbid, John Cena breaks his neck and needs spinal fusion surgery and he's going to be off for a year. In a lot of ways, I think it would be good just because it would be a good way to freshen up Cena's character and get him off television. But that would be awful for the company because they rely so much on him. For him to be gone, not just, oh, he'll make appearances but he can't wrestle, to be gone for any length of time would almost be crippling to the company because they've done such a poor job of creating a new John Cena. CM Punk may be the closest thing, but Punk still isn't at Cena's level. And so for them to lose Cena to a major injury would be the absolute worst thing that could happen. I don't see how you can even compare the two of them. This other thing, Cena could just come out and apologize. You know, people are very forgiving. Or it could come out and it could not mean anything. It could go over like a fart in church and nobody cares. And like I said, if anything, more of the male fans are John Cena fans because they think he's a pimp and a player. I don't know. But I think an injury would be far worse than any sort of proof that he was cheating on his wife. I hate to say that too, but it just feels like it's almost way too commonplace in society today where people cheat all the time, and after a while, you know, you kind of get numb to the whole thing. You hear about it with athletes and politicians, and John Cena is a little bit of both, so I suppose we really shouldn't be surprised by all that. If you have questions for the mailbag, the email address to send them to is thesolomonster@gmail.com. I still have a whole bunch of emails from you guys I have to get to. I'll try to get to you directly if I haven't gotten to your question on the air, so I apologize for the backlog. But that is the email address for questions and shout-outs. And you can follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster. And again, if you want to check out some photos from the WWE Be a Star Rally in Brooklyn this past week, I got some photos and a video as well up on my Twitter page, so check that out. Friend me on Facebook, facebook.com/TheSolomonster. If you see the illustration, the wonderful illustration by Steve Willerette of yours truly, you know you have reached the right place. Send me a friend request and I will approve you. And again, we have a great discussion going on each and every Monday night during Raw and the pay-per-views, a lot of great debate back and forth. So it's a really fun time on Facebook. You can subscribe to the show in iTunes, type in the name of the show. And you can just click subscribe, and any new episodes, whenever they may be posted, so if I happen to do a rare weekly, or rather a rare weekday sound off or something every now and then like I do, and you're not on SC Scoops and you miss it, if you are subscribed in iTunes, you need not worry, because it will automatically be downloaded for you. And I want to thank the person who posted a new review for me in iTunes this week. I don't have your name written down, but there was a new review posted, and so I do very much appreciate that. And again, subscribe to my YouTube channel as well. My username is TheSolomonster, all one word. If I do post any vintage episodes of The Sound Off from way back when, those going forward will exclusively be on YouTube. So if I do post one later this week, you should probably subscribe to me on YouTube, and then as soon as it goes up, you will be notified of such. So get on there if you're not already on there. And I think that about does it here for episode 225 of The Sound Off. I want to thank each and every one of you for spending 90 minutes of your life listening to me ramble. I very much appreciate it. I'm trying to get the times for these shows down, by the way. I'm still working on my time management when it comes to this stuff. So I know a lot of you wish they would be longer and not even shorter, but you are crazy. I'm trying to make these shows shorter, not longer. So I got to work on that. And again, there will be no new Sound Off next weekend. I don't know if I may be able to do a show around the 4th of July maybe or something like that. I make no guarantees, but there will definitely not be a new show next weekend, and I hope to return the following weekend with episode 226. I apologize. I will be in Vegas, and perhaps I'll be doing some live tweeting from Vegas. I know there's a big UFC show that actually happens to be in Vegas the weekend I'm going to be there, the big Chael Sonnen Anderson Silva fight. I think it's at the Mandalay Bay or MGM Grand? I think Mandalay Bay. I will not be at the event. I'm actually not going to Vegas for that purpose. I'll be there for a bachelor party, but who knows? Maybe I'll bump into some UFC guys while I'm in Vegas. Maybe I can get them to record a little something for The Sound Off. You never know. So anyway, until then, be well, stay safe, thank you for your support, and we will see you very soon for another episode of The Sound Off. Take care.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solar Monster sounds off on SEScoops.com.